Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday, the 22nd of June. I'm Phil Carroll.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy Although it's not the 22nd, it's the 19th today.
We're recording this on Friday, and it's Phil's 29th birthday, so he tells me. So happy birthday, Phil.
Oh, wait a minute, I got the date wrong there, haven't I? If I said the 22nd, it's the 21st. I can't even get my 21st. Start again. Go on, carry on. I'm joking.
I was going to say, I said, like, you drive around Europe in your supercars, right? In your shirt with your three buttons down. It's such a more relaxed calm.
He just needs some chest hair so he can. I haven't got me
Tom Selleck Magnum PI hair and chain on the eye. No, mate, I've just got off the bike. It's the birthday ride, and I am literally sweating. I've like chuck on the linen shirt.
I did the same yesterday. Just so hot, isn't it?
It's going to be 30.
Humidity. It's just
I love it how they have to invent a new word to describe. It's like the heat dome is coming from Europe.
Oh yeah, but then I see Kevin kind of that sits on the beach for the past 3 months in Hawaii. I'm the only person left in this trio who does any real work. It seems unreasonable. But I'm
looking forward to getting back to doing my work during the day, I have to say, is all I can say.
Yeah, your classic 4 in the morning. When should we record a podcast? Should we do it at 6 in the morning, team?
Yeah, or like 6 in the morning, all right. And when he's back home, you can't get him up before 10 a.m. at his time anyway. He's brilliant.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Anything going on in the world?
Well, what's going on? I mean, we obviously saw some interesting news this week, didn't we? We got the news, well, actually, to this morning, that Andy Burnham has won the Makerfield by-election. No surprises, I don't think, with almost 25,000 votes, defeating Reform UK's Robert Kenyon by more than 9,000 votes. In the victory speech, Burnham said the result could be a turning point for British politics and warned Labour that it was their final chance to change. The win strengthens Burnham's position as a potential challenger to Keir Starmer's leadership, although he would still need the backing of at least 81 Labour MPs to enter a future leadership contest. The result is being seen as a significant political boost for Burnham and sets the stage for a potentially turbulent period with Labour. So, first question is... Is Burnham going to be the next prime minister, do we think?
Well, he's a man of the people, isn't he? Have you seen the interviews? Have you seen that comedian taking the mickey out of him? He's hilarious. He's basically, I'm a man of the people. Look, I'm looking at that bush. Isn't it very good?
I think the thing is, right, the bond market, when he gets into power, is not going to like him at all. I mean, his ideas are just crazy. But, you know, whatever. I mean, all our politicians are useless. But I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, if you follow the media, you'd think that, you know, it was quite a close call. But actually, if you add up Reform, Restore and Conservative votes together, he still beat them all with a decent number of votes. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think
it was a landslide. He had over 50% of the votes, wasn't it? It was 51% of all votes. So that's a big victory.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, people, you know, his name is that people were voting for Andy Burnham specifically, not Labour. But I do wonder whether it's, you know, because the turnout was much higher than normal.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether it's not so much people voting for Andy Burnham. But do you remember when the Conservatives and Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson and Theresa May, they were so unpopular? So Keir Starmer got a massive majority, not because people wanted Labour in, but because they wanted Conservatives out. And people voting for Andy Burnham now, they're voting to get rid of Keir.
Did you see the news? Did you see Reform being interviewed this morning? So John, is it Tice, I think he's called?
Tice, that's it.
He was being interviewed this morning, and basically he was being grilled by the BBC reporters, and they were saying, well, what is a big defeat for you guys? And they were basically saying, no, this is an expected result. All the Reform voters said they wanted to get Andy Burnham elected so that they could then, that was a way of getting Starmer out and that they would win the future seats.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. And the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, often you're voting for the individual. So, like, in Exeter, our previous MP was Ben Bradshaw. He's a Labour MP, and I'm not traditionally a Labour voter. But he, as an individual for the city, has been really good. You know, so there's other concerns to think about, but I think ultimately the key thing to bear in mind is that for Burnham to win, he needs the support, I think, of Ed Miliband, and Ed will want to be Chancellor. Now,
Oh, good. That will work well.
indeed, but ultimately, I think that's where we're going. So, you know, position accordingly, and I think it'll be not ideal for the bond market or politics, but there's a lot of companies. Energy Pathways is a good example, but there's others. You know, European Green Transition. Just have a look at, you know, a government that's going to support, you know, British companies in, you know, energy storage or green energy space. There's quite a few. You'd be pleasantly surprised. But yeah, there's something worth thinking about.
Okay.
Yeah, well, the rest of the market's crashing. They're going to be
Well,
doing
indeed,
okay.
those two
Yeah.
will do really
Yeah.
well.
Is that Well, let's talk about the
what
other news this week. Obviously, hopefully the positive news, the formal agreement between the US and Iran to end the Middle East conflict, prompting Washington to
trying to
lift its naval blockade and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The deal triggers a 60-day negotiation period aimed at securing a broader settlement, with Iran agreeing in principle to measures including the destruction of its enriched uranium stockpile and commitments on regional security. While President Trump hailed the agreement as a major diplomatic breakthrough, critics argue it gives too much away and fails to permanently eliminate Iran's nuclear ambitions. Markets will be watching closely as the reopening of the key shipping routes could ease pressure on global energy prices, although tensions remain high, with Israel and Hezbollah continuing to exchange strikes despite the agreement. So great to see that. Do we think that there'll be this, obviously, this 60-day negotiation will end well? I mean, it seems like Iran are saying that it's not a good deal for the US, and I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, I believe the talks in Switzerland have already been postponed. That's a couple of hours
Great.
ago. Vance, no, JD Vance isn't traveling to the talks, but ultimately, the US has dropped its naval blockade. The problem is, right? It's really, really ridiculous to say, but the problem is what Trump is giving Iran is worse for the US and better for Iran. So it looks like Iran's won, and Trump doesn't like that. And ultimately, the oil reserves in the US are going down to critical levels, so they need to get the oil flowing again. And inflation's obviously rearing its ugly head. But it's you know it's I really do think that if Iran would just be quiet, right, and just say, you know, just let Trump just say this is the best deal for the US and the entire world, and just, you know, they win in reality, but he can win in his own mind, it would be fine. But they can't help but just say, we won, you lost, we won, you lost. And
Yeah,
yeah, I think that's
but
basically it. It's his ego.
yeah,
That's all it is.
but the reality is that for the people in power in Iran, they did win. You know, the actual Iranian people didn't. They lost big style.
Yeah.
But you know, this is you know, how are you going to look at it? I mean, the whole issue really is, I said it on last week's show as well, is what's happened in Lebanon. Everybody's ignoring. You know, the Israelis are going in there still and hammering the place. I said last time, my friend has been arrested. He's still in prison because he's a Christian. Simple as, you know. And there's people and organizations that are in power in Lebanon that basically are trying to prevent whatever they can, because they're like struggling now. You know, they're struggling that anything that has a connection with Israel in any way, shape, or form, bang, they're gonna clear it out. It's
Well,
horrible because
the problem is obviously that, you know, Israel says they're targeting Hezbollah, right? And whether you believe that or not, you know, Hezbollah is operating there. But the problem is that is when you target people with bombs, you're inevitably going to kill people who are not Hezbollah, right?
yeah.
And then you create the problem that you're trying to solve with weapons. And that's basically been the history of the Middle East for
Yeah.
centuries.
They are targeting Hezbollah, but actually they're targeting that land. Israel wants that land. You know, it's the Greater Israel Project, whether you like it or not. And I think Trump has also lost his temper with Netanyahu as well, because they're just going on their own plan, and that's what they want. They want the land, and they're going after it. Gaza's the same. The West Bank is going to be the same. Don't be surprised if the West Bank's not targeted next. But it's been by a thousand cuts, the West Bank. You know, it's like, let's
It's been
separate it,
going for
separate it,
decades and
separate it.
decades. Yeah,
And
yeah, yeah.
that's going to happen. But anyway, What's has anybody been watching the World Cup?
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah, good
what an
match.
opener. What an opener for England. I mean, I don't think anybody would have expected a performance like that against what has I've always described as a bogey team, Croatia. I thought it was excellent performance. I mean, the first half was a bit flaky. Second half was really, really impressive. I don't know what you thought.
No, I did. I thought we were impressive.
I thought exactly the same. I thought the first half, I thought, oh, this is classic England. And the second half,
One
I'll tell
goal up,
you.
1-1, 2-2, 2-1,
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
that
Oh no,
whole
now we're
thing.
gonna
But
lose.
yeah.
But I tell you, it was fun, right? For the first, like, you're watching it, and you could tell they were just enjoying
I
themselves.
thought Kane was very, very lucky with that penalty, even though he was off the line. I thought we were look normally we would not have been given that as
I
a
mean,
retake.
ultimately, right? It's this is the kind of it's the same with VAR and like other rules in football. Is that like there's the letter of the rules and there's the spirit of the rules, and in the World Cup, the letter always tends to win. So had it been the other way around, I reckon, we would have suffered. But it doesn't, yeah. I mean, personally, I think it's just the way it is. It doesn't feel clean though.
What about
But
some of the upsets, Kev, as well? I mean, obviously we've seen Spain struggle at, drew against Cape Verde. We've seen
yeah, that I mean that's the
Portugal.
result of the century, that one, isn't it? Nil nil against Cape Verde. But I mean they're basically like they've got 12 fishermen probably playing. I mean, I don't really know the details of
Yeah,
it, but
and then Portugal, like Ronaldo struggled against DR Congo, which was another absolute shocker for me. Because like, what has impressed me was Argentina. Obviously, Messi in his sixth World Cup, which he sets a record along with Ronaldo. The fact that they've managed to play across six is incredible. But the fact that Messi on his, sixth World Cup scores a hat trick, what a performer he is.
What
Well,
they
he.
didn't tell you is all the DR Congo, all the DR Congo players had AK-47s down their trousers, while
Do we
Don't
think
you dare score.
don't take the mick, mate? Do you remember the Colombian keeper that was taken out and shot because he let that penalty in by one of the cartel back
Outrageous.
in the day? The Medellin cartel shot him. He was incredible.
Yeah. Oh, outrageous. Outrageous.
Do we think Messi can win again?
I do.
Yeah.
I really
Yeah.
do think
He's hungry
Argentina
for it.
is hungry for it. He's
Well, he's definitely good enough to win it. Not on his own, but
Yeah,
if
but
he
you
has
look
a
at
good
their
defender.
team with like McAllister, with
Yeah,
their
it's strong,
team is
isn't it?
incredible. They have got amazing players of Argentina.
Yeah, I'm not sure Brazil are up to scratch this time around. I think France look good. Who else is there? I mean, the three favourites are France, Spain, and England.
Portugal are one of the favourites.
Yeah, well, no, the three favourites as it stands at the minute with the bookmakers are France, Spain, and England,
England, yeah.
which is pretty shocking for the English, I think,
Yeah, I
really.
mean, the thing is, there's not an easy game now in the World Cup. We were saying this. There's nothing that you can say is going to be de definitive. Do you know what I mean? Like a bit like the Premiership, you don't know who's going to win on the day. So it opens it all up. But we've got a busy show this week. So let's move on to our first guest. We're joined by Andrea Cattaneo of Zenith Energy. And Andrea joins us following news this week that the European Commission has approved a 23 billion euro Italian renewable energy support scheme, which Zenith believes could be a major catalyst for its 188.5 megawatt Italian solar development portfolio. The scheme provides long-term state-backed revenue support through 20-year contracts for difference, potentially enhancing project financing options and increasing the value of completed solar assets. With construction of Zenith's first solar project in Italy set to begin next month, it's a timely opportunity to discuss what this means for the company, its renewable energy strategy, and the wider outlook for the Italian solar market. Andrea, welcome back to the roast. So, for listeners who may not be familiar with the significance of this announcement, can you explain why this new Italian support scheme is such an important development for Zenith and its solar portfolio?
Yes, thank you. The most important element in photovoltaic activity and production of electricity from solar parks is the future prices and the understanding of the trend. And this is something that is always more complicated than the oil price because the electricity price may vary even during a day of 100%. And in relation to the photovoltaic production, the cause of it is that the peak production of electricity at noon correspond with the zero consumption of electricity in certain sectors, like for example, industry or housing for air conditioning or for heating in the winter. So there is an enormous need to have a craft in managing the pricing curve, the long-term prices and the short-term prices. This is something that is best done by mega traders, which they have the technology, the management, and the clientele to hedge. They can have a contract for 1 year, they can have a contract for 10 years. Above 10 years, even the financial markets of electricity, they have a very narrow space. And so what is exceptional of this subsidy is that it gives a fixed price for 20 years, which is something that is unheard of. So you have, Phil, purchased yesterday a solar park, and you have a solar park that is brand new, and then you know that the solar park will produce revenue for the next 30 years. But the point is that when you go to the bank, which is a non-believer, then the bank will say, well, produce electricity, thank you very much, but how much will be, and what will be the price in 20 years? There are articles in the press saying that the electricity price go down, and there are articles in the press that they say that there are data centers, the electricity price go up. But what to believe? And so in reality, the opinion in electricity prices are much more confused than the future prices of oil and gas. In the oil, we have the agency, energy agency in Paris, which gives a lot of forecast and expectation. But even today, when the oil price are going down after the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, there are people that they say, hang on, we are consuming the reserve. At the moment, the stock is going down instead of going up. And so then there is a risk that we will have certain scarcity of specific petroleum products like jet fuel. It can be making machiavellically to increase the air ticket during the summer. We don't know. But just to say that this oil price has a tremendous impact in the electricity prices, because electricity is mainly still done worldwide in gas and certainly in Italy. And so the origin, to explain to the audience, of this huge subsidy is the request by the Italian government to assistance in a moment in which the electricity price, which is made by gas, becomes very expensive because of the crisis in Qatar.
Absolutely. And just while we're on the oil and gas, I want to just touch on the announcement that was early June, where you signed an exclusivity agreement to acquire 82% of the controlling stake in Daybreak. And I believe you've got a 90-day exclusivity period to conduct due diligence. How do you think that's looking, and how do you think that you can kind of redevelop that project to produce more barrels of oil?
Thank you, Phil. The first thing is very important, because we don't want to have in our shareholders base or potential new shareholders confusion about our strategy. We have steel production of fossil fuel in Italy, producing gas and from gas electricity, and we have steel production of oil in the remaining two fields, which we preserve despite the expropriation attempt in Tunisia. And so we are still an oil producer. And we are a believer that we are a provider to the community of energy in various shape and form, and which can vary as well in the future with some addition. The most recent addition is uranium, which we'll touch in a few minutes. But the point about the Californian oil is a classic case of geopolitical change. California was possibly the most difficult state of USA to go to produce oil. And instead, the fact that we have been able to see such a shift in the sentiment of the government in USA about oil and gas has permitted the reopening of new drilling license in California, and then again for Zenith, which we remind to our shareholder is historically based on an opportunistic, cheap acquisition path and model, then we have the opportunity to buy something reasonably functioning at a fraction of the price that originally was invested on it. So taking all the joy of the large investment that has been profuse on it, but that for various circumstances, previous owner couldn't bring to fruition.
Yes, and on the legal side of things, can we get an update there, Andrea?
Yes, of course. You know, I would just say two things. We have done, which are one, the cause of the other. We have done a tremendous effort for a company of our dimension to bring a stellar team in the weeks, in the 3 months, actually, before the start of the final hearing in the World Bank in Paris, building in Paris. This has been initially the taking in December of Ben Juratovic, which is an ex-Freshfield and so successful that then eventually he went in his own and became a barrister, a King Counsel today, and then member of Excess Court, one of the most distinguished chambers of barrister that we have in England. We should remind to our audience that the arbitration in front of the ICSID is a treaty arbitration, and the treaty that has been breached by Tunisia is the treaty United Kingdom Tunisia. So that required somebody that is super competent in the aspect of the treaty UK Tunisia, which is obviously a British lawyer. And so that him and his team with Antoine Gregoire. So we are speaking about a team that is top in the world about the treaty, specific case, treaty between UK and Tunisia, you know, and is not generic arbitration. That we had already a very famous professor, Thomas Claes, that is the new president of the committee that Macron, the president of France, made for the restructuring of arbitration law of France, very important task. But this we had already since 2 years. And then we join then as well with Julie Spinelli, which again is another fresh field. And this fresh field lawyer, a lady, has been instrumental and key in the hearing in Paris, which we describe in a second. And then the third stellar lawyer, the president of Europe, Charles Michel, that has returned after a very successful political career as prime minister of Belgium and president of Europe to his original job, which was arbitration lawyer. So these three stellar additions have represented an investment and a move of Zenit to give to this arbitration for 573 million, the best chance, the best shot to be won. In addition, we have had, point two, very good evolution during the hearing, because the deposition of the Tunisian witness has caused some unhappiness at home, at least. We don't want to speak about comments of the case till it is awarded. But going back, the delegation on Friday night, the 24th, then weekend, then Monday morning, they went to the president to report, we suspect, and we expect. And then during the night of Monday night, the president fired the Minister of Industry, Mines, and Hydrocarbons. So that are good indication that we are doing well, that the addition, technical addition, I would say, not only personalities, but technical addition have brought a strong argument to our case. And the case, it may be longer by 1, 2, 3 months because of the magnitude of the elements we have brought to the attention of the court, which the court has recognized their worth investigation and they are investigating.
Yeah, I mean, they've the other side has not exactly acted in good faith over the past few years. So, you know, I expect that to continue. I mean, the other thing is, I noticed the other day, I think you are an Esther, actually, the $23 billion Italian scheme, as you said, the European Commission's approval, that's going to be hugely positive for the stock, right?
I believe that we have been blessed by a coincidence of our actions and the decision, of course, completely unrelated and in parallel, of the European government and the Italian government. Because in a span of 1 week, We have had the 4th of June, the first step in the lower chamber, the Parlamento, of the approval of the SMR, small nuclear reaction, small modular reaction, reactors, which are, of course, for the production of nuclear energy, and they are supposed to be much safer, more environmentally friendly, and of smaller but more handy dimension, in a way to be put in various places rather than in the central huge nuclear station like in the past. Mm-hmm. And this had been approved the 4th of June. And then on the 10th, so 6 days later, there's been the grant of this subsidy. So the two pillars of our activity beside the arbitration, the solar and the uranium, have been blessed by this decision of the government.
Well, it's interesting in uranium, because we'll talk about, or maybe Kevin wants to leave the conversation on Revale in a minute, but I noticed, because I track Italian politics, it was only a couple of weeks ago, I think it was on the 4th of June, the Chamber of Deputies passed a framework bill, you know, 155 votes in favour to 86 against, legalising a path back to sustainable nuclear energy. Now, obviously, Italy previously banned nuclear in 1987 because of the, you know, Chernobyl disaster. But obviously, the country's opinion of uranium is changing, and that vote literally a couple of weeks ago shows you how much that opinion is changing as well. And they're also considering small modular reactors too, which, you know, Rolls-Royce were in conversation with. In addition to that, in June last year, they signed the EU's Critical Raw Materials Act into domestic law, and, you know, uranium related to that as well. So it all seems to be, you know, from a country that was very anti-uranium, and, you know, Germany was very anti-nuclear, suddenly energy security because of Russia and Ukraine and because of the Strait of Hormuz closing, opinions have changed very, very quickly. Would you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is very nice for us and for our investors, the timing of this decision, because they are just on the verge of our listing of Revale in London.
So on that note, Andrea, tell us about Revale, or however you pronounce it in your...
not Revale, but Revale. I think that is even an English word, okay. but certainly a French one. So
I'm thinking of the army, the Revale.
Revale, yes. And so I think that is exactly the name what is needed, an awakening of the fact that the fossil is still the greatest percentage in energy production in the world. Unfortunately, fossil oil and gas mainly remained very much linked to an area of tremendous unsolved political problems, the Middle East, and then even worsening, because for many, many years, since difficult relation between US and Iran have been caused by the coup d'etat and the return of Khomeini from Paris, another gentleman, not the Khomeini, which is a different spelling, that with father and son is running Iran at the moment. And so we are speaking about circa 60 years of confrontations. But then never Iran asserted the idea, which was maybe an easy trick, but they never had the idea to block the Strait of Hormuz. And then instead, this new feature to blocking the Strait of Hormuz has become so crucial for other states, all the Gulf states, which they are then unable to defend themselves and unable to take a position that is scaring in any shape and form Iran. So we have the price of oil and gas, because LNG come from Qatar, which is near Iran. The price of these fundamental steel commodities is shaken and is on the edge. It may go up, it may go down. Nobody truly can say to know it. So what instead we can do in Italy with the photovoltaic and as well other form of renewable like eolic and biogas is to create a production of independent, European, steady price source of energy.
Tell us about the IPO that's going to come to the market next week. And the asset obviously is an asset that's in Italy already, had a lot of work historically on it. and tell us how that's all going to pan out. How is Zenith going to benefit from that? How are Ajax going to benefit from that? Your son Ippolito is going to be running that story, and you're going to be the chairman. But yeah, explain why you decided to spin it out as opposed to leave it within Zenith.
Yes, I would really just conclude on that note, because the relation father to son can be misperceived. We are an energy company since 19 years, and we have learned a lot of different crafts. First, we started to produce oil in Argentina, then gas in Italy, then from gas we become producer through gas of electricity. And so we have done a variety of learning curve, becoming an operator recognized by five different governments, so having the technical and financial capabilities. We have never been a miner. So uranium is an energy item, but is classified as a mineral, and so it goes under mining. And above all, the technical aspect necessary to produce uranium is a mining technology with different type of employees, different type of drilling, and different type of odds, because the difficulties of mining are totally different from the difficulties of hydrocarbon. So in front of this reality, we had two possibilities: to join forces with John Brown, the ideal CEO of an Anglo-Saxon mining company in Canada, UK, or Australia, somebody that we have never seen before, or to consider that by chance, because it has been his own choice and his own route in life, my son, incidentally, has become the CEO of a quite successful mining company with the technology of mining, with activity in mining, that has already some very important shareholders in the sector of mining, so with the credibility. So we thought that this was in the interest of Zenith and as well of our stakeholders, because we are as well investing in mining of uranium with various community that depends on us for our safety. The best was to add our technical and financial capability as Zenith in environment and in other matter related to energy, with the addition to the competence of a mining company, which is Ajax. So this is the reason for which there is Ajax important participation in Revail. Zenith will remain the largest company. Myself, I am the chairman representing the interest of Zenith and Zenith shareholders, but a mining company should be run by a miner, a miner. And so this is what my son is.
Very good. From the perspective of valuation, how, you've said it before that anybody with a reasonable asset in uranium, in certainly based where it is in Europe, where we don't have any uranium, basically, you know, what could this potentially be worth?
Well, you know, I have always said what is the truth, that there are in the Western world a majority of uranium activities being owned by the state. And then this is a classic case in Kazakhstan, in Russia, in Canada, in France, as well in the United States. Then there are as well a variety of medium caps and small caps, proportionally to uranium, small caps, not micro, as you will see, that are listed in Australia, in London, and in Canada, and in Sweden. All these companies, the smallest one has a market cap of $50 million, the smallest. So we are quite optimistic.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's hope that that works out, and for the benefit of, you know, Zenith shareholders, Ajax shareholders, and anybody who's involved, obviously, in the IPO and before.
Okay, I'll say Andrea Catania, CEO of Zenith Energy. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you very much for your time, my friend, and looking forward to see you after the pricing of Revail settled something fine, higher level than the IPO price.
So next up, we're joined by Mark Creaser, Executive Chairman of Astrid Intelligence and CEO Siam Kid. Astrid has been in the spotlight following volatility within the Bitensis decentralized AI ecosystem after the exit of a major subnet operator. While some commentators question the implications for the network, Astrid's view is that the event actually demonstrated the resilience of the protocol, with infrastructure token balances and governance mechanisms continuing to function as intended. The company says it remains focused on operating validator infrastructure, expanding network level services, and developing Astrid Arena, its competitive AI trading platform. At the same time, both Mark and Siam have demonstrated significant confidence in the business, each investing £150,000 to acquire 166.7 million shares at 0.9 pence, taking their holdings to 2.63% and 3.01% respectively. Mark, Siam, welcome back to Sunday Rose. It's great to have you back.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
It's great. Absolutely. I'm always impressed with your radio voice. We're like chatting normally and then it's like boom. Straight into the radio.
It turns it on. So for listeners who may be new to Bitensis and decentralized AI, can you explain what happened within the network recently and why Astrid believes these events actually reinforce the long-term investment case rather than undermine it?
Wow. So everything, which event are you referring to? Because something changes pretty much every week at the moment in Bitensis.
I think it was the exit of the major subnet operator that I referred to at the beginning.
Oh, I mean, that was the 10th of April. That's like 3 years ago in Bitensis years. So yeah, what happened is the owner of subnet 339 and 81, a guy called Sam, I think a lot of the fame got to his head. So his subnet Templar, subnet 3, they did a 72 billion parameter model, a distributed pre-training run. And that was something which was very impressive and something which a lot of AI experts said was impossible, even a couple of years ago. And so it got Bitensis a lot of eyeballs. And all of a sudden, people thought, wow, actually, there's some teeth behind this Bitensis thing. And then I think he got lured away and then he just left, which, you know, happens. Sometimes people leave. But it's sort of he's been completely overshadowed because 2 weeks ago, Subnet 9 IOTA, another very good subnet, just casually whipped out a 100 billion parameter model distributed pre-training run. And they've got a 1 trillion param model run in the works right now. And this is important. I know it's like, well, what does it matter? A lot of the pre-training runs at the moment, they're done in massive data centers, all in one place. So it's all about coherent compute, training a model. But you can't do that if you have, or it's a lot harder to do if you have, you know, a few computers here and there or all over the world. So you have to sort of orchestrate all of the compute into training a model. And this is something that Elon Musk is going to struggle with, because one of the things he wants to do with his cars is that every single Tesla has a very advanced AI computer chip. And he is saying that when you're not driving and it just sat there, you know, on the driveway for 90% of its existence, you can basically contribute your car's compute towards training. So he's going to have this problem of several million cars all over the world trying to, you know, allocate compute to training. And I don't think he's solved this issue yet, but Subnet 9 has. And now it's just a matter of scaling. But I mean, yeah, out of the 128 subnets, there's always a subnet that's doing massive things. So, yeah.
You know, from my perspective, and you're welcome to, you know, to rebuttal it, but Sam's argument was basically about centralization, right? He was basically saying that three-person governance committee is a facade and Steve's exercises unilateral control. Whereas, you know, Jacob is basically saying that's just completely not true. The network is designed to be hard-coded and permissionless mechanics. And basically what happened when Sam left, the token fell because, you know, that's the biggest subnet operator just saying that this model doesn't work. And yet, obviously, it's continued. And so the question is, you know, who's right? And that's basically the problem. That's what we need to ask you.
When Sam left, it's not fair to write off everything that he said. But I know that you weren't. But he was angry. And he was also very emotional. The thing that he was doing, you know, coming out of the ecosystem that had supported him, you know, writing off relationships with everybody that had invested in him. What he said, his narrative alongside that, I don't think was particularly well thought through and articulated, there is an element of truth in there. And the element of truth is that with this goal of decentralization that BitTensor has, it's not there yet. But all that speaks to is the fact that we are incredibly early. And it is a very, very complicated, like we are reimagining an entire world economy within BitTensor. And any economy is complicated. There are lots of moving parts. There are lots of incentives. There are lots of things that are hardwired into the protocol. And there are some things that need to be flexible. To suggest that out of the box, BitTensor was absolutely perfect just is ridiculous. As it's tried and tested, it needs to iterate. It needs to change. And it needs somebody, some people, to make those changes. So there is an element of it's not decentralized because some people wield influence over it. And I'm delighted that that is the case, because there are people that are passionate about this project that try different things to see if we can solve for that issue. I think it is very possible that there has been an overreaction to Sam's exit in terms of the number of different changes to the protocol that have happened to make sure that sort of thing cannot happen to investors again. But all it speaks to really is we're very, very early.
You look at the the longer term ambition, you know, what BitTensor is trying to do, right? And I think people kind of get a little bit confused about this sometimes, because it's not like any other cryptocurrency in existence. So you imagine a nervous system, right? This is how I imagine it, and maybe you want to comment, but I've always thought of it as a nervous system, right, for artificial intelligence. So you've got thousands of specialized neurons competing, collaborating, getting paid based on the quality of their thoughts. And the issue you have, like the large language models that, you know, potentially we all use, is centralization. So the AI industry, if you use ChatGPT or Claude, you're accessing a model that costs hundreds of millions to train. It's running on infrastructure worth billions. It's fine-tuned with data that you're never going to see. And ultimately, you know, the US government can come along and say, well, that model, you can't use it anymore. And away we go. Now, you're a tenant, basically. You're not an owner. You can get kicked out of the house, and the terms can change at any time. But the open source alternative, right, this is the other problem, is that you can say, okay, you can run your own models. And that sounds appealing. But if you're going to train your own competitive LLM, you know, unless you're a multi-billionaire, you're not going to be able to get very far. So the idea of BitTensor is if we coordinate thousands of independent machine learning systems into a coherent whole with market mechanisms determining value and blockchain coordinating trust. Now, yes, there's been some negative, obviously, with Sam leaving, that's not been ideal. But the longer term vision is a different way of running the world and the global economy. And therefore, when you say we're early, I believe you. And BitTensor, for me, is pretty much the only cryptocurrency to be in now, if you're looking for a long-term future.
A couple of analogies will help here. Bitcoin is a decentralized, when it started, was a decentralized peer-to-peer value exchange. Mm. And in the first couple of years, Satoshi Nakamoto was very active in the community. A lot of people don't understand what a decentralized network is like. There's always centralization from the start. Someone releases code into the wild and then has to nurture it. And it's a bit like a parent-child relationship. So if you have a kid from the age of like 0 to 3, it is completely defenseless and or maybe up to 10 years old. When it's living under your house and your care, you are the parent, you're in charge, you have to guide and nurture it. So, but as that child grows and gets bigger, you are slowly releasing more autonomy and control to that child. And then by the time they're, you know, 15 or 18, you can't tell them what to do. And then they leave. So in that analogy, BitTensor, in my opinion, is probably only 5 years old. So it has to be nurtured. Also, BitTensor is not a crypto. And I know it straddles three lanes. It straddles the AI world, the crypto world, and the VC world, because there's 128 independent AI startups. And that's what attracts the VCs. And Mark and I are subnet VCs, but it's not a crypto. And it doesn't annoy me, but I think it pigeonholes BitTensor in completely the wrong box. It happens to use a distributed ledger technology for efficient resource allocation. Because if you're setting up a subnet, BitTensor, you know, you have miners and validators help running your subnet. BitTensor is the orchestration layer that helps pay and reward and judge and score and prune and kick out all the good and bad actors. And that way, you know, with a subnet, you know, if we bring it back to Astrid Arena, We have, obviously it's early days, but we have a good 30 to 50 miners on our subnet. So these miners are people contributing to the AI trading code. And like, we have no HR, we don't pay them salary, PAYE, national insurance. These are people all over the world contributing to our particular challenge, and there's no HR. BitTensor sorts that out. And so, yeah.
I mean, can you just really quickly, Astrid Arena, right? So the idea is basically it's, I don't know if there's a good word, a battleground maybe for trading agents to compete. Where do you fit in terms of where do you generate profit from Astrid Arena?
Yeah, so at the moment we are in the intelligence gathering mode. I do chuckle because I've been trading for over 22 years now, and I've always been the biggest trading robot critic. I've never in my career, other than, you know, some of the massive quant firms and high frequency trading firms out there that have spent billions on this, I've never seen a trading bot that's worked more than 6 months. Because, like, especially in the retail world,
it's just a fishing bullshit market. Well, it's, even if you find something that works, it'll work for about one day before the market follows up its edge. So
yeah. And most just have martingale systems, or they'll have like a 1% take profit and then a 99% stop loss. And so they have like a 95% win rate, and then the one losing trade wipes them out. So so at the moment, we're going back to your where's the profit. So we're in version 3 arena now. So all these miners are, they're contributing their code. So the AI training agent to code, we run that and validate it behind the scenes. So we can see, you know, are you being truthful? And the standard is really good. We're, you know, all of the, most of these miners are making a lot of profit in our monthly competitions. So what we're doing is we're building this Astrid baseline bot, and we are fine-tuning this model so it doesn't have volatility, because ultimately there's three ways that we're going to make profit or revenue here. One, we want a really consistent bot that we can hang our hat on, so we can put a couple of million pounds of our own money behind it, which will then generate more revenue than our OPEX. Two, we can then obviously license this. But three, with these bots, in a monthly challenge, which every week there's a new challenge,
yeah,
they're doing 200 to 400 trades per bot. And in each competition, we have 250 slots, 256 slots. And so when we move to version 4 in a couple of months, where we go back to the AI trading agents actually trading their own accounts, they're all going to have a live trading account of, I don't know, $1,000 on Hyperliquid or some decentralized exchange. And then we'll get a percentage of the performance fee, of the trading fees, which will be very chunky if we have, you know, let's say over 200 bots doing 200 to 400 trades in a month.
I mean, do you get, sorry, I feel like I'm cannibalizing all the questions. This is my last one, and I'll hand over to Kevin and Phil. But do you get, other than the capital, do you get access to the logic, the reasoning, you know, that execution data from the winning models?
Everything.
Obviously, valuable in itself. But the only other question I would have is, okay, so you're the AI agents are, you know, you're running basically monthly competitions. And the idea is obviously that if somebody, you know, there's a quant engineer somewhere in the world develops a better agent, it's going to outperform and outcompete and, you know, defeat the other agent that, you know, may have won in the previous month. But does that not optimize for the highest risk, you know, quant models? And therefore, you know, it might do extraordinarily well 1 month, but then actually you've got a huge amount of risk. Or how do you quantify that?
Yeah,
sorry, I know it sounds like a cutting question, but it's, yeah, this is the risk. This is the problem that we have had in the traditional finance world, right? Doing it almost exactly the same thing.
Yeah, we're creating a new benchmark. So you can't just, you're correct, you can't just rank them based on the P&L, because someone could then just, you know, put the jacks up under that leverage. Not that we allow leverage in our competitions, but we've created the Astrid score. And the Astrid score it comprises of a bunch of different models. So a lot of people look at the Sharpe ratio when they're looking at funds and the odd, you know, the other thing. But with the Astrid score, we have a composite of about six different ratios. I mean, the Sharpe ratio isn't even in that, because on its own, it's a bit of a clunky one. And so we want to create the Astrid score, which is the best way to evaluate an autonomous trading system. And we've still got a few tweaks on that. I think we need to add in a couple more different ratios. But yeah, a bot that has a very good Astrid score will be very good. So low volatility, consistently reliable and profitable across all market conditions. And there are six market conditions: bull, bear, ranging, steady and volatile. As in steady, yeah, volatile, you know, as in steady bull market, volatile bull market, etc.
Kev?
Okay, Sam, so the last publicly announced number you had was about 18,000 tau. Now, based on all of the systems that are going on, and there are lots of complicated things that you've got in subnet 127 and all the different scenarios, that deals that you've got, some of which you haven't been able to announce and some of which you have. If I was to say to you by the end of 2026, based on the run rate of how much you're going to be able to gain from these deals, forget about the price, the underlying price of tau, what sort of percentage increase from that 18,000 would you expect by the end of this year, by the end of 2027? Because I think people want to grasp and understand how this just grows on its own with what you've got already invested.
Go for it, Mark.
You're handing that over to me. Well, I think this is the time for your maths, for your thousand
tau. You've got
maths
to start sharing your screen and going, we need a 20-minute tutorial on how it will exponentially grow.
If you're staking it, I'm not sure whether you are, but you know, reward rate for me is around 10%. It ranges anywhere from 6 to what, 15, 16 at the moment. So you take a 10% average and you compound it. No?
Not for you. No. All of the subnets have an APY of between 30 to 90% APY.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not talking... Oh, so you're on the subnet level. I was talking on the parent level.
Just for explanation terms, all of the tau that is owned by Astra Intelligence has been taken down to the subnet level, and they're basically then having the APYs on those subnets, depending on which one it's invested in, what situation you're doing. And we don't know all of those because you haven't told us all the different investments that are in play, for, I presume, very good reason, because you don't want anybody interfering with what is currently going on. So this is a question that I think I want to have an idea of, because you obviously have already calculated it, because you're Mr. Maths genius, Sam.
It's not quite as easy to calculate as
no,
you might
be
on face value there.
But we can because calculate it,
even
in
if
a
you
range, no?
Even if you calculate, like, well, if we buy this much alpha in that subnet and this is the APY at the end of the year, we're going to have this much. Yeah, you can broadly calculate that within a range, but that alpha can be re-rated against tau hugely. You know, so you could end up with twice that figure or half that figure or any other number. So
yes, no, I understand that.
Yeah.
But the subnets ultimately that you've invested in, you anticipate that most of them are going to increase in the positive. Otherwise, from 128, I would hope you wouldn't have chosen all the crap ones, excuse my French. Is that fair to say?
I have to stress that we're not an investment firm. So we, with the subnet tokens that we have, they are all strategic. Now, going back to the yield thing, a good rule of thumb and a very pessimistic rule of thumb is that if you buy a bunch of subnet tokens over a 3-year period, the amount of subnet tokens that you accrue over that period triples. And that's a very pessimistic outcome. So if you look at, so the amount triples. And then it's a case of, okay, what is the price of those subnets in 3 years' time? Now, structurally, and the way that BitTensor is made is that it's highly unlikely that the average subnet price will be lower in 3 years' time than it is now. And I don't want to go too much into the weeds why that is, because there's there is constant algorithmic pressure for the average price of subnets to go up over time. And also the deregistration price of a subnet goes up over time. I know we've got a little bit of a dip at the moment, but it does go up. And the lowest price subnet literally just gets booted out of the network every 4 days or so. And so it's a self-healing, self-pruning network. And so average prices of everything go up over time. So one of the things
tau inflation. So
which bit?
I'm just saying, you're saying everything is going up over time. We will call it tau inflation.
Okay, yeah. It's no different to Bitcoin. If you look at the distribution schedule of Bitcoin, it was designed so that 90% of the entire supply of Bitcoin was spat out in the first 10 years or so. It has a halving every 4 years, etc. And we're sat here now on the plateau of that emissions curve for Bitcoin, with about 92% of the supply. And the last Bitcoin will be mined in the year 2140. BitTensor is exactly the same. Tau is there, it has the same schedule. So a lot of the supply is spat out in the first few years. So just over half of all Tau that will ever exist is already out there circulating. So, but because of that high inflation rate or the high emissions rate, if you're in, it's counterintuitive. You're not actually diluted. Like in a stock, if Astrid were to just issue constantly more shares every day, every 72 minutes, the holders would be diluted every single day. And it's not necessarily the case with subnet holders. It's all
okay. So to take your answer, every 3 years, was it every 3 years you said it triples?
Yeah, pessimistically. Yeah.
Okay, so pessimistically, then, if we had 18,000 tau, if you two guys are absolutely rubbish at your jobs, we have 54,000 tau in 3 years' time, and tau is currently the same price, $250 per.
Yeah, let's say the price stays flat for 3 years. We're in,
so then we're talking at a market capitalization of the company somewhere in the region of 13 million, 14 million pounds, which is more than twice what you are at the minute. Now, none of us are invested to achieve those results. We are invested so that your competence and knowledge in this network will increase those tau significantly. So give us a few ideas of how you're doing that.
Of how we're currently doing that. Well, I mean, we do have tau in quite a lot of different subnets, and we do try and pick the subnets that are going to increase in value faster than the median increase in value of all subnets. Plus, of course, we do own our own subnet. And when you own your own subnet, then you get emissions into that subnet. And then if we can turn that subnet into a profitable revenue stream, then we could buy our own tokens to increase the value of our own tokens, which would in turn attract better miners to our own subnet, thus increasing the depth of our moat, and meaning that people are much more likely to contribute their intelligence to our project, meaning that perhaps that could be more profitable, and then we can just circle that back around and buy more of our own tokens. So there are a number of ways afoot that we can grow our alpha and tau holdings much more rapidly than just sitting either in root or in subnet alpha.
Yeah.
So my next question then is, what made you invest 150,000 of your own money at this particular time?
The price was wrong. The price of the shares is just wrong right now. It doesn't reflect where we see the value in the business. So it just was an unbelievable opportunity to invest in Astrid, and we both took it.
Yeah, Mark. I mean, I'm insanely bullish on our future, as in Astrid's future, BitTensor's future. Like BitTensor is this massive tsunami, this wave that no one sees. And at the moment, Mark and I and Astrid, we're sat there on our jet skis. We're not on a surfboard. We're on a jet ski waiting for this, because you'll need a jet ski to ride this wave when it comes. And
I'm currently in Hawaii. Please let's not talk about tsunamis.
it's just the only annoying thing at the moment is that we are very early. Like, from a tokenomics perspective, remember, BitTensor is identical to Bitcoin. So you can literally look at the Bitcoin chart and go, oh, that's where BitTensor is right now, based on the supply. We are where Bitcoin was in 2013. Now, everyone, every man and his dog says, oh, I wish I was in Bitcoin in 2013, etc. In reality, most people, you know, we could teleport you back to 2013 right now with your knowledge. But most people get scared out or bored out because people don't like the volatility. So we are early. We're going to ride this immensely. And BitTensor is that wave that I know is coming. And we have to position ourselves so we capitalize this as best as possible. Also, going back to what are we doing to make sure that we do that, Arena is the business. So I have some regrets, actually. Some of the regrets are when I go onto some of these share sites and I still see the descriptions of, you know, what Astrid was or our very first business plan of Astrid before we even started. And it talks a lot about, you know, validator infrastructure and all that sort of stuff. And I sort of cringe at going, oh, that is like 2% of the business. 98% of the business is Astrid Arena. And at the moment, we've got, when you look at the miner emissions, so the emissions that are paid out to our miners every single day, it's roughly 11 TAOs worth of our subnet token. Now, the higher the price our subnet token goes, obviously the miners get more. And like Mark said, the higher the price of our subnet, it attracts better miners. So we have firsthand knowledge. There was a subnet last year that was doing very well. The price was just rocketing up. It was attacking the software coding assistant type thing. It was like Claude Code and Cursor. And we know that Anthropic engineers were going home after work and then mining that subnet, because it was doing something very similar to what they're doing in the real world. We also know firsthand that we have DeepMind Google engineers in London doing their work. They go home and then they were mining a subnet at home. And so the goal is that we can generate more revenue than the miner output, which means that there is a positive flywheel. So our subnet price can only go up, because if you're doing more buybacks than miner sell side, your subnet price goes up to the point where, you know, a quant at, you know, Medallion will look at this and go, wait a minute, I can contribute to Astrid Arena and make more money in a month than I do in a year at my job, at my investment firm, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, every subnet has this potential positive flywheel. And the key thing to unlock it is revenue. I'm obsessed about revenue.
Just explain again how you were suggesting that in the first or the fourth cycle of this arena, that you were going to make money from the trading pockets, if you like, or the trading funds that these bots were going to be trading. So how do you make money from that?
Yeah, it's percentage of trading fees. When you place a trade on any trading platform, Hargreaves Lansdown, all the way down to a decentralized trading exchange like Hyperliquid, if you're placing a trade or that's worth £100, let's say, you're probably going to spend anywhere from 50 pence to £4 in trading fees. Well, when we have our competition on, you know, V4 Arena, we're going to have hundreds of bots trading hundreds of trades over a period of a month in one, you know, and that's just one battle. And we'll get a percentage of the trading fees.
Okay, you're going to tell us the percentage or not?
We don't know.
We don't know.
So we don't know. Like we've earmarked Hyperliquid, but there are a few other trading exchanges out there. It could be OX Markets. We're looking for the best one, but typically it's a bit like an IB agreement. We could expect something like 20% of the trading fee.
Yeah.
Because we'd make all of the AI trading agents open an account through our link per se, and that way their account is always linked to us.
Yeah, you're effectively getting the introduction fees on the trading things. And if they trade, let's say, 200 trades in a month, is that what you're talking about? Or is it 200 trades in a day? You know, I mean, I presume some of the bots are very frequent traders as well. Or is that not?
The average is about 200 trades over a month period per trading agent. Okay. Some do more, some do a bit less. But the key thing is that we have this, we then have a knob, we have a dial that we can just rank up, like dial up the revenue, because we'll start off with demanding all agents start with $1,000 live trading account. Okay, we'll then see what our revenue is. That could be north, I think that'll be north of £100,000 per month in revenue there. And then if we want to dial up the revenue, we go, okay, now in order to compete, you need a $5,000 trading account.
Spinal tap dial up to 11, I hope.
No.
Yeah, exactly. And when we get to that state, it really does mitigate a vast majority of the exploitations or the gaming, because what miners do, they're always looking for the shortest route, least effort, maximum reward. And so by having your miners actually trade with live money for whether it's a grand or 10 grand, like they can't then just like we caught like a lot of miners get disqualified because we have pretty cool systems out to see who's cheating, who's being fair. One guy that had like 36 bots all doing just a whole array of different things, and but these 36 bots were linked to one IP address. We're like, you broke the rules there.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the Jammer idea is that anyone can come in and compete, and if they build a subnet that's better than yours, then basically they take your lunch, and that's the way it should be. That's how the system is built. But the bigger your particular subnet gets, it's solving a particular problem, whether that's trading or something else. You know, if it's someone wants to come in and build a new subnet, you've got the chicken and egg problem, right? Because trying to put it simply, like miners can't join without emission allocation, the validators won't participate without the miners, and the network won't allocate emissions without value. So you can't demonstrate the value without miners and validators. And so you have the situation where you are now, there's competition for what you're doing. But once you demonstrably prove it and it goes up the value curve, it becomes harder and harder to challenge you as well. A year, 2 years, 3 years down the line. Would you say that's fair as well or not?
Yes.
Yeah. Over time, as you become more established and the numbers get bigger, your moat gets deeper.
I mean, it's impossible, isn't it? You get to the point where, you know, somebody's coming in and they want to create like a trading bot or similar. They're not going to go on another subnet because the...
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of BitTensor, really, is that it attracts intelligence. So if you've got intelligence and knowledge, BitTensor is the place where you can get rewarded for it. And of course, you direct that intelligence at where you're going to get rewarded the most. Intelligence, you know, that's the whole point of the incentive mechanism. So if Subnet 127 has got very, very healthy alpha price, and we are emitting, you know, a good deal of value in the direction of our best miners every day, then that makes it very, very difficult for somebody else to come in and start nibbling away at our lunch. That isn't to say that they couldn't. If we were doing a bad job, then somebody else could come in, but they would likely need to be kind of well-funded to start attracting those miners rather than try and do it organically.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite, I mean, in technical terms, it's not impossible, but it's not easy to set up a subnet either, you know? And I think a lot of people who don't understand this space because the thing is, I mean, the argument is you can just come in with a load of money and set up a subnet, but you also need the connections, you need to know the right people. You know,
it's
incredibly
hard to set up a subnet.
Yeah, it is, because it's not, because you mentioned money, it's not for me, it's not really, the money is part of it, the technical skills another, but also you need the trust of the network, of the people who are already in it, and trust is hard to earn, I think, it's basically the key issue.
Sam, last question from me. Over the next 6 months, can you see that by Christmas you're going to have, you know, the battle of the bots in Astrid, you know, and these guys could be trading with $100,000 each, not one?
Oh, yeah, we're aiming, like I was pushing Leo the other day to get V4 out within 2 months. So, like, I am obsessed with revenue and you know, revenue is the oxygen in the air that every company needs. So I'd like to get V4 out in a couple of months. So that way we start getting a percentage of all of these trading fees. And also we've constrained the arena parameters at the moment. So if you look at just the basket of what they're trading, it's gold, Ethereum, Tau, Bitcoin, Doge, Monero and Hype. It's a tiny, tiny list. Once we're more established and we have a lot of the harnesses and rails that everyone knows what they're doing in the miners that we're doing, we can just open this up. We can open this up to stocks. And the thing is, the competitions are monthly, but every week there's a new competition. So at any point in time, there's going to be a two or three different parallel competitions. But we can, again, as our alpha price expands and our revenue expands, we can open up that constrained set. So we could have like a dedicated gold competition, and then the world's best gold traders can come out of there. I was thinking energy trading as well. So Subnet 18 is Zeus, which is the world's best weather forecasting AI. And I was thinking, wait a minute, like if we had a competition where it is just energy trading, Zeus could then be our miner for that, competing against, you know, energy hedge funds. Like there's all sorts of different things we can do. And there's like once we get the revenue, there's nothing saying that, hey, instead of having two or three concurrent 1 month battles, we can have 10 concurrent battles. Because ideally, at heart, I'm a trader. Having a 1 month battle is a bit of a sugar cube. You can't really gauge anything over that period of time. I would like, you know, quarterly challenges. And so if we had, let's say, 10 or 20 concurrent challenges, but that they're all lasting a quarter, I think you'd get much better signal, much better intelligence. And also, you know, you can do it so every week there is some big winner out there in terms of winning the prize pools, whatever that may be at the time.
So our current return this year is 84% for just under 6 months. So would any of the bots beat us?
Yes. Yeah. Like already, like these bots are doing 20% a month. If you go to AstroDream, I mean, the current active battle, I mean, it's not even a month old. It's, what is it? It's 20 days old. And they're, you know, the two winners are about 22% up. But so often,
22% compounded. If you can continue to, you know, produce that, surely it's going to make a great deal of sense for Astrid to match the trades on some of these things.
Yeah, this is why we're creating the Astrid baseline bot. So all of the winners, like if you take the top 10 miners of every competition over a month period, they're doing 10 to 20% a month. And what we're trying to do is like take the essence, the intelligence and the learnings of that algorithm and actually dumb it down as much as possible and like get rid of the volatility and have something which is bulletproof that makes, you know, 2% a month or 5% a month, to the point where we're like, holy crap, we're just going to, you know, this is so good enough for us to just put a couple of million behind this just as a background thing. You know, I would like just all of our OPEX to be covered just by our baseline bot. So yeah. Yeah. I'd like way more competitions in parallel, competitions to be longer than a month. You get better signal that way. Yeah. And yeah, just expand every constraint because we've got our thumb over the end of the garden hose at the moment.
Yeah. No, it sounds fantastic. And I can understand why you've put 150,000 in. I don't know why you didn't put more, but maybe it's because you weren't allowed to or what. I don't know.
No, the honest answer is that for the last 3 years, 99.99% of my net worth has been in BitTensor. So it's very hard for me to sell subnets, to sell Tau. I reluctantly sell Tau if I have to pay for a family holiday. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think on that note, we'll say Mark and Siam, Astrid Intelligence, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best mover I've got on this Friday morning is Ascent Resources. They're up some 50%. They announced that the arbitration proceedings in the Energy Charter Treaty claim against Slovenia have formally closed, marking a key milestone in the long-running dispute. And the case is being heard under the International Centre for Settlement, the ICSID, is now awaiting a final award, which the tribunal expects to deliver before the end of June. So obviously a lot of movement and anticipation priced in there, 50% up. Any thoughts on that one? We've talked about ICSID before. What do you think of the chances, Charles?
Yeah, I think they've got a pretty good chance. I would also say if you were buying very cheaply not so long ago, there's no shame in taking profits on the way up. And that's how you should play all arbitration stocks. No matter how confident anyone sounds, anything can happen in a courtroom. I think it's kind of interesting that the stocks I've made, maybe not the most money on, but very, very handsome returns when you're looking at Emerson or GreenX or Zenith. You're actually the arbitration stocks is a really underlooked way to make money in this space. And ultimately, the reason why they're doing so well at the moment is that a couple of years ago, if a state just nicked your asset, they could just ignore you because critical minerals didn't particularly matter. Now, critical minerals do matter, and states want to get financial investment, and they want to, and they're competing for investment, so they want to look like attractive places that actually, apply the letter of the law, so they're engaging in the exit processes. And yeah, hopefully, this one will again work out well, and send a warning to states, that they can't do things that they're not meant to. Basically, it's
Well,
that.
Zenith is a good example of that, isn't it? I mean, is it Algeria
Tunisia.
that Tunisia, sorry, yes, Tunisia haven't had an internal, outside investment, or not internal, outside investment from anybody since all of these court cases started taking
Yeah,
place.
100%. But it's the funny thing is to rem what you have to remember is that all of the court cases are always about, these are not criminal complaints, they're civil complaints. So the idea is to bring the complainant back to where they were before the state intervened, right? So often they talk about dollar amounts, but sometimes it's just, here, have your licenses back, have some financial restitution, here's what we're going to go do together. And I think, to states who are, digging their heels in, particularly when it's a case that they're definitely going to lose, there's always a way back to come to the negotiating table, say, we're sorry, here's your license back, here's some money as compensation, let's go build a plant, let's go build a mine. And it's the same with any civil case, And that happens a lot more than what people think. It's only the high profile cases where it goes down to the wire, where it doesn't. But I wouldn't be surprised to see in the case of Zenith, for example, a deal being struck before, a hammer comes down in a court. But we'll see.
It's trust, though, at the same time, isn't it? It'd be very difficult for them to trust them to do it.
Yeah,
But
that's true.
okay, next one is Priority Intelligence, up some 43%. They secured a strategic partnership through the Half Space business with Sport and Recreation Alliance, becoming its official AI partner and gaining access to nearly 300 UK sports organisations and an estimated 15,000 users. So, good to see that one moving. I think I checked it earlier in the week and it was actually trading a significant, it was down quite a lot, but it's good to see that one with a bit of volume.
Yeah, they had a finance deal come out, and it got smashed. And then they announced the announcement you've just mentioned, and it recovered a significant amount. So I think it was the end of the previous week that it got smashed, and then came back. But yeah, I mean, I think they're aiming for 500 clients by the end of the year, I think is what was said in one of the RNSs. If they do that, they're probably going to be cash flow positive and an AI company valued at not very much basically. So yeah, let's see where it gets to.
Okay, and then the next one I've got is Skin Biotherapeutics, up some 35%. I think that's Restoration of Trading, but I believe that one is all I could find on the news. But BSF Enterprise, some of the shakers were down about 15% after they announced that the Paris auction of the T-Rex leather handbag successfully demonstrated the strength and commercial potential of its advanced tissue engineering platform, despite bidding of €150,000 falling short of the reserve price. The handbag has now moved into a private sale process, while the publicity generated has accelerated discussions with major automotive and sportswear companies interested in the company's biosynthetic materials. Sounds like handbags at dawn for that one.
I think they're probably right that they got themselves a hell of a lot of publicity, but I think they would have rather had £500,000 plus as well, or €500,000 plus, or whatever it was in terms of the minimum. And to get only 150,000 was not great, was it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's one of those stocks where they don't have much cash and have to resort to, placings or whatever to get it away. But it's also one where, there's so many strings to the bow, it could a blue sky RNS can just come out of, drop at any time. But do you want to be owning those shares while the dilution is ongoing until that comes? And that's a difficult question to answer. Basically, there's a point at which it becomes fair value to you as an investor. And yeah, that's just a personal risk reward calculation. But I do think if you look at just take away the company and just look at the IP, if you were to like sell it on the private market, as in everything that they've done, whether it's the work they've done on, on eyes or on the lab-grown meat, or the dinosaur T-Rex leather. There's so much in that IP that is value, which is more than the market cap right now. And I think that if, at the, for example, you say, they're trying to sell one handbag for 100, and they only got 150 grand, sure. But what's the IP behind that worth compared to the market cap today? And
Yeah,
that's
so
only one aspect of it. So yeah, it's worth thinking
yeah,
about.
I'd argue with you that income theater is the same. You know, the IP they've got on their products is vastly more than the market capitalization they've got. So these companies, I think, cannot just be valued on the potential revenue, or the revenue now, or potential revenue. I think the IP is almost, got to be valued significantly in all of, or not all of them, but these companies especially.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we will see. We will see.
Charles, I want to get your take on one of the biggest market stories of the year, which has been this blockbuster IPO of SpaceX, obviously, which raised around $75 billion at $135 a share before swelling to about $85.7 billion after underwriters exercised additional share options. I guess that makes it the largest IPO in history, and it's valued the Elon Musk-led company around $1.77 trillion on listing. And obviously, we've seen them surge to more than 30% to around, I think it pushed briefly around $2.5 trillion. What do we make of it? And I think you wrote something about, or you mentioned that it's obviously sucked a lot of liquidity out of the market. We saw a bit of a liquidity vacuum on the sort of weeks or days leading up. But just give us your thoughts on the valuation and what it means for future IPOs.
Yeah, so in terms of the valuation, I mean, it was quite clear that on the first few days that it would just rocket, no pun intended. And then, ultimately, in my view, will crash like one of the early SpaceX rockets. Whether that's a few days or a couple of weeks later. Ultimately, the thing is with SpaceX is that you've only got around 5% of the shares in float available to the public. So just the demand for those shares will just send it up way higher than what any normal valuation should be. Now, if you look at Tesla, Tesla has at times, and I think is currently worth more than every other automaker in the world put together, right? And it has done for a long time. So when you try to apply traditional financial metrics like revenue, I mean, you might say SpaceX makes barely any revenue. Well, it doesn't particularly matter. People are investing into Tesla because they think it's the future of all cars and robotics, and they're investing into SpaceX because they think it's the future of the space economy, right? And when you say, well, we've only developed the GDP of one planet, this one, SpaceX are looking at the other seven planets and going, we can develop all of those. How ridiculous that might be, I don't know. But ultimately, the valuation isn't based on fundamentals. It's based on financial engineering. There's so many shares out in existence. And institutions, individuals, index funds are all chasing them. But ultimately,
Ultimately, you bought some and made a
and
nice
made some
profit.
profit and I sold them, right? Because that's what you do. Now, but the thing is, here's what's going to happen. The insiders are going to unlock, right? In the reasonably near future. And let's say you're a lunch lady at SpaceX sitting on, £1 million, £2 million worth of SpaceX shares. Your life is going to change if you sell those shares. You are not going to hold on to them. Even if you're a senior engineer, you might have been working there for 5 or 10 years. You're going to sell them on the open market. You just are. And then as those shares unlock, is the demand for those shares going to be enough to prop up the valuation that they have? I don't think so. I think it's just going to gradually fall. And over the next sort of 2, 3, 4 months, it's not going to do particularly well. Having said that,
I think the brokers believe it's worth just under $1 trillion, and I think
Well, yeah,
that's
I mean, Morningstar was talking.
where it'll
Yeah.
end up probably.
Well, probably, but then the problem is, right, is that every other company in the world you could apply those metrics to, but you can't do it to SpaceX because you're investing in an individual, which is Elon Musk. And as much as I want to say it'll crash, and I think it will fall below the IPO price in the not too distant future. You got to remember, like when Tesla was being created and he created that options package for himself. There's videos all over the internet. You can see, CNBC analysts saying this is ridiculous. It'll never get to a $1 trillion valuation. It'll never get to what he says it's going to. And then he did, he cornered the entire EV market and sent it up to like multi, $1 trillion plus valuation. And then they said, oh, no, we're not going to pay out your shares or your bonus, your reward that everyone said was impossible. Now, a lot of Elon's financial incentive tied to the SpaceX IPO is. He retains control of the company, by the way, so that's a risk factor to consider. But a lot of his incentive is establishing a colony on Mars, right? Now, everyone's saying that's impossible. If he does establish a colony on Mars, fantastic. And people think it's impossible, but he's done the impossible so far. And the only other thing I would say is there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, Elon shouldn't be a trillionaire. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. And I would say to you, well, you know, the biggest problems in the world, whether that's climate change or space exploration, what he's doing with Neuralink and with his tunneling company, those are all massive, major problems. Do you think the government would solve it better? Do you think if that money were in the government's hands, they would spend it in a better way? You know, I think personally, if you're going to make one person in the world very wealthy and tell them to go have fun and fix world problems, it'd be him. Complicated thoughts, basically.
Yeah. Just something a little bit lighthearted this week before we sign off. Did you see ITV, their coverage of the World Cup, the England game? They found themselves in hot water. I don't know if you saw it, but the viewers accused the broadcaster of sexism by asking Emma Hayes to analyse the World Cup but what many thought looked like a kitchen. She had like a chalkboard in there. Did you see it, Charles?
Mm.
And it was like, I must admit, it was the most random thing I've ever seen. Why did they put Emma Hayes in what looked like kitchen with drawers? And everyone's going, what's in those drawers? Why is the set so random? It was bizarre.
It was bizarre, but then also, you know, not being like rude like Emma Hayes, but like, she's also an adult who can, you know, if we were doing a video podcast and I had a little blackboard and started drawing, like, come on, you know, like, you also have to take individual responsibility. I think this is actually the thing that irritates me most in the UK, or one of the many things, is the individual is also responsible for stupid things that they let happen to them, you know?
Yeah.
Why not talk to Emma Hayes and go, what the hell were you doing?
Yeah, why did you do that? I agree to that.
But,
did you
but,
not
but
question
ultimately,
the set?
But ultimately, the other thing is that, like, you know, in a world where there's terrible things going on in the Middle East and in Russia and Ukraine and, you know, various other places, it's come on, someone made a little mistake, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's a little bit funny, but it doesn't matter. And a lot of the manufactured outrage is, you know, in my mind, it's just like, does Emma care? Do the viewers? You know, what, 40 people probably complain now, viewing audience of millions, like, it doesn't matter, does it?
The good news is her tactical analysis was actually pretty damn good, I thought. So, yeah, fair play to her for getting it right. But
indeed.
Anyway, what's going on next week? What we're looking forward to? Anything going on, guys?
We've got
World Cup.
World Cup, yeah. Obviously,
yeah,
we've got England, Ghana, I believe, on Tuesday night, 9 p.m. BST.
Yeah, we got this. I'm still going to call it Revali, whether you like it or not. We've got the Revali IPO. We've got Talon IPO as well, which is going to be a US-based or Canadian-based, I should say, gold project with off-the-chart grades, I have to say. So that's going to be an interesting one to look out for.
Yeah.
What else, Charles? Anything else coming next week?
No, not particularly. The IPOs, those two IPOs are probably the most important things to keep an eye on. There's not that much going on. I think, like, most, obviously, a lot of the companies we track are resource companies, and almost all of them are preparing for drill programs in Q3 / Q4. Do you know?
Yeah.
So we're all kind of like in the hold the breath phase.
Or production in the case of.
Or production. Yeah. But I think, you know, we're going to have a much busier second half of the year than we, you know, might be used to generally. And it's going to be super exciting watching all of these assays come back, watching these companies get into production. Because a lot of this stuff and stuff that we have been, you know, supporting, tracking, working with for the past, you know, 5 years in many cases. And they're now coming to fruition, you know, and whether that's, you know, Colin Bird's stable or others, you know, when we were, you know, even when we were in London a couple of years ago with Colin, you know, talking about Bazant and African Pioneer and Extract, and he had all of these wonderful ideas, and, you know, we saw the vision then, and not many people bought into it. Watching it come true as he sends those photos through on Twitter, it's quite fun.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
No, it is. And those valuations haven't got anywhere near where they should be.
Well, they're not. The thing is, we've seen lots of small mine builds go awry, right? But we're looking at production. Bazant, take it from example, he's saying Q3, right? And I think he's hoping for sort of earlier in Q3 rather than later, but just say Q3. Because you get paid at gate, and he's made very clear, you know, we get paid at the gate by our offtaker, you're going to see first revenues in Q3 if all goes to plan, and that will re-rate the stock. Because that's all the market wants to see, is money coming in. and then you have another month of revenue, and then away we go.
Yeah, I also don't think people have quite grasped the African Pioneer deal with the Chinese, because you know that's basically completely free carry all the way to production, and you know 26% of the value of the production. So the question I was asking somebody that I was speaking to is, they're saying it would cost between 40 and 60 million to get it there. Okay. Mm. And I think that's being very conservative. So would you rather African Pioneer went out and tried to raise that money, $40, $60 million to keep 100% of it, which is going to smash your amount mm-hmm. that you own? Or would you rather have a fixed amount now at 26%? I mean, Eastar did the same, didn't they, with the same company?
So did Ariana and various others. And you yeah. know, the thing is with Shanghai is they've built hundreds of plants. They know what they're doing. The execution risk, should they decide to go ahead, is very low. And I actually find it's actually really interesting, because if you compare Hope and Gorob in Bazant and then obviously Ongombo in African Pioneer, they're both similar style copper mineralization mines. They're both Colin Berg companies. They're both in the same jurisdiction in Namibia. They're both basically a long strike from each other, even if they're very far apart. One, Bazant, has gone down the route of, we're going to own, you know, 90% of the project. We're going to finance, you know, we're going to take some offtake finance, but we're going to take on the execution risk. And then we're going to retain the lion's share of the profit and rewards. Whereas African Pioneer has gone down the route of, and this is mostly because obviously they didn't have an NLZM plant right next door, but they've gone down the route of allowing Shanghai to deal with the execution, and then they get a quarter of the profits. And it'll be very interesting to see, given that you basically have like a twin data set, right? Which one is going to be more successful? Obviously, they're both successful, but which one does better over the next 2 or 3 years?
Because I would say, Colin Bird, I think Colin Bird's alluded to the fact that there are other potential assets around Ongombo, which will change the game for African Pioneer.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's wait and see what happens there. Anyway, I think that's enough for today, guys. Yeah. And thank you.
We will wrap up and say, yeah, if you do like what you've heard, please subscribe, hit the bell icon for future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend all. Enjoy the fantastic weather.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.